Okay, you guys made it back. If you traveled, I did. 5 hours late, snow, airplane delay, but here I am. I made it. So don't forget about the final exam. Maybe I won't give the details again today, but I will repeat them on Thursday. And I think the homework's due this coming Monday. Yeah. Sadly, the last homework set. Yeah?
Can we get another one?
Just for Anthony.
Okay, so yeah, today I want to talk about, we had developed the stress tensor, Maxwell's stress tensor last time, which I think takes some applications to get used to it, how it works and what it tells us. So I'll do one last example of that today and show that we can get the same answer we got before by energy conservation arguments for the force that's pulling a dielectric slab into a parallel plate capacitor. See how we can calculate that. Then we'll move on to sort of AC circuit theory, formulated in the kind of abstract E&M framework, and see how it connects to how people talk about AC circuits with impedance and so on, complex impedances. So let's set up this first problem with a parallel plate capacitor, two metal plates separated by a distance D. I've made them rectangular, and a rectangular slab of dielectric that just nicely fits within the space between the plates. We will connect this to a battery, hold the plates at constant voltage difference V. So you can also think that there's a charge minus Q on one plate and plus Q on another, which is related to V by the capacitance. But I'll go through the energy conservation argument second, but let me first do the Maxwell stress tensor treatment. Of course, this is very idealized. Like when you treat a parallel plate capacitor, you're ignoring the kind of fringing fields that go on here. And probably there would be some also at the edge of the dielectric when it's partly inserted inside the capacitor. But anyway, I have this distance X that we extend the far surface of the dielectric slab inside. And so we'll calculate the stress tensor. So first of all, we only derived the stress tensor in vacuum. So I'm just going to postulate the generalization to linear media is the first step. It's one of the few things in the course I'm not going to derive. This is actually a homework or a problem. I don't think it was assigned. Problem 6.9. If you want to look into doing that yourself. And that generalization, T alpha beta, is E alpha D beta plus H alpha B beta minus a half delta alpha beta E dot D plus B dot H. So it's still quite simple and easy to use. And don't forget, what this means is, remember, it's the dot product of the normal of a surface vector on into this tensor will be a new vector. And that will be the direction of the force or the stress on that surface at that point. So in this context, T alpha beta for this problem with the simplifications, idealizations, ignoring the fringing fields and so on, I'll say there are two expressions. There is at the x boundary, it will look like epsilon naught E alpha E beta minus a half E squared delta alpha beta. So that's the boundary inside the capacitor, boundary edge of the dielectric, just inside the dielectric where it's vacuum and it's not yet actually in the dielectric. And the other surface I'm taking is just infinitesimally outside here, or really right at that boundary, which is inside the dielectric, where we still have these fields, but with dielectric constant epsilon, because that surface is in the actual dielectric. Okay, so let's make our T with XYZ coordinates. It will be either epsilon naught or epsilon, depending on which boundary we're talking about. E squared is appearing basically everywhere there is a non-zero field. So it will be V squared over D squared times a dimensionless matrix, which is just minus a half, because there's no electric field in X or Y, of course, so there's only this second term contributing. Only in Z does this these first terms contribute. And there they will be diagonal, and so it'll be minus a half, plus a half, will be our stress tensor. Right, and the indices are, you know, the usual XYZ. Okay, so next we need the dot product of the surface normal, outward surface normal, right, which will be for this boundary. It's in the positive x direction, and for this boundary, it's in the minus x direction. So, n hat dot t at the x surface is epsilon naught v squared over d squared. This minus 1/2 here, n hat dot x hat times x hat. And this n hat dot x hat at this boundary will be plus 1. stuff for the other surface. I guess I can just write it here. And that T for the zero surface is epsilon V squared over D squared times minus a half again, n hat dot x on that surface is minus 1 times x hat. So these simplify to epsilon v squared over 2 d squared x hat. It's positive at the zero surface in the positive x direction, and it is negative in the boundary inside with a factor epsilon naught. Okay. You follow the logic? Okay, so we add the surface directions to find the net force in the x direction, and on the dielectric slab, epsilon minus epsilon naught v squared over 2d squared, the area of that slab, or of that surface, right, which is the length L I didn't indicate, that's this length, times the separation d, is the area orthogonal to the x coordinate. And in the x hat direction. So the E field is pushing the slab into the boundary and into the capacitor. I should say pushes, because we're doing kind of pushing. You would have to hold it to keep it from accelerating in. Okay, so let's show the energy conservation argument. Basically, I worked this out in some detail in my solution to homework set 1, I think, how you calculate the force on a dielectric. Or maybe that was a slightly different calculation. Maybe that was the force on the capacitor plates, that problem. But it's the same sort of logic that we'll go through. You have to be careful when you're doing this problem with a battery involved or a power source that is providing a constant voltage as you're changing something, either changing the capacitor plate separation, or in this case, changing the position of the dielectric slab. You have to keep track of the energy done by the work done by the power supply. Okay, so this is an energy conservation argument. Which will give the same answer, but let's prove it. Okay, so what we're imagining is that we're holding onto the slab. Really hard. Keep it from accelerating. But maybe letting it go in from x to x plus dx. So So let's set up the energy conservation argument. The change in the energy stored in the fields will be this. And so that should be equal the change in the work that we do which we could write as our force dotted into dx. Plus the work done by the battery. And this will be V times the amount of charge transmitted, or V squared DC. Now here, what's the capacitance as a function of X? That will be the sum of epsilon naught L times L minus X over D. Okay, it's like two capacitors in parallel here. So it's this, the capacitance of each part with and without the dielectric. This is the part without, and this is the part with the dielectric. Epsilon LX over D. And what we care about, I guess, in this whole derivation will be DC DX. DX. DC is DC DX DX, and DC DX will be epsilon minus epsilon naught L over D, and that multiplies DX. We plug that in for DC and we get the following equation: 1/2 V squared DC DX DX equals force we apply dotted into dx, and again that's the force we apply to keep it from accelerating. So that'll be the negative of the force from the fields plus v squared dc dx dx, and so we can solve for the force we're applying. Dot dx is minus 1/2 v squared dc dx times dx, which will be a negative force. We're applying the force in the negative x direction. We have to apply a force to the right. Okay. And so the force from the electric fields is, of course, minus the force we apply. It's 1/2 v squared dc dx, which is epsilon minus epsilon naught v squared over 2 d lx hat. Right, same answer. Okay, so I found that a useful exercise, because to me, when I first learned about the stress tensor, it just seemed a little nebulous, and it's kind of nice to see it give a sensible answer in one application. Any questions about that derivation? It seems a little tricky in a sense. I think the only thing that I question about this derivation a little bit is drawing this imaginary boundary just to the left of this slab as defining this surface, and then this other surface here, which is in the slab and still in the capacitor, you know, still feeling the full voltage of the capacitor. That's not clearly an idealization, but I guess we are making a lot of those same idealizations when we use the normal derivation of the capacitance of a parallel plate capacitor. Okay. So I think we will now go on to section 6.9 in our favorite tome. And start talking about AC fields. Which is obviously an important subclass of all, because of all the alternating current sources that are being used essentially everywhere in the world. And basically this is going to aim at Poynting's theorem in a little generalized context from what we encountered before. Because we'll apply it to harmonic fields. When you see the word harmonic, of course, you should think periodic oscillation, a simple sinusoidal sort of oscillation. Should be what springs into your mind whenever you see this kind of word, harmonic fields. And this will lead us to the identification of where we see coming out of the general theory things like impedance, a key concept in electric circuit theory, and admittance. Okay, so what we're going to specialize to is we're going to look at a class of solutions to Maxwell's equations. It's a very simple thing you can do is take Maxwell's equations, assume everything in those equations has the same time dependence. Which I call for harmonic fields or sources, monochromatic time dependence. So there's only one frequency. And everything goes like e to the minus I omega t. So what is often done, since Maxwell's equations, especially with linear media, are totally linear, is one introduces a complex field. Of course, every field that you can actually measure in the lab will be real. So we'll write, for instance, an electric field at a position and time as the real part of the complex electric field, but we'll do most of our calculations on the complex field because the math is just so simple when time dependence is a simple exponential. It's easier to differentiate than making a cosine and so on and keeping track of phases. So that means it's the real part of this complex field, which we can also write as 1/2 E of x e to the minus I omega t plus e star conjugate of x e to the plus I omega t. And I'm only treating real frequencies here. That's real, the real frequency, the fields are going up and down, the 60 hertz from your wall outlet, if you like. So, what is going to often happen, like when we calculate energy or rate of power being done, we'll often calculate a quadratic quantity with these harmonic fields. And the math is actually pretty simple. If you take the real current density, for instance, this little aside is about the time average of quantities, quadratic quantities, when you have harmonic fields and sources. And so I'm picking one example, like we are sometimes interested in J dot E when we want to calculate ohmic losses. And those are the real fields, okay? So let's go through that, because a very simple result comes out of this that you have to remember if you're going to do anything with harmonic fields. So this will be a fourth J of X e to the minus I omega t plus J star of X e to the plus I omega t times, or dotted into, E of X e to the minus I omega t plus E star of X e to the plus I omega t. And you can see when you expand out the four terms, there will be two that are time independent, 1/4 of J star of X dotted into E of X, right, J star of X, and the time dependences will cancel. And then there's J of X dotted into E star of X. And then we have some time-dependent terms survive, like J dot E will have a time dependence E to the minus 2i omega t. And term J star dot E star E to the plus 2i omega t. This whole thing can be rewritten as a half the real part of J star of X dot E of X plus J of X dot E of X e to the minus 2i omega t. And so now if you average that over one cycle, which is the way time averages are usually computed, which means do the integral 0 to from t equals 0 to 2 pi over omega and divide by 2 pi over omega, then clearly this term will vanish. And you're left with this simple theorem that, and this holds for all quadratic quantities. You really need to remember this. Final result, or quickly rederive it if you forget it. The argument is pretty simple, but it's a formula you'll use all the time if you're doing circuit theory. Because usually we don't care about the field, the energy going up and down, or the ohmic losses on this time scale. We want the kind of time average of those quantities. So this is the conclusion that the time average of any quadratic quantity involving harmonic fields and sources can be expressed with these brackets to indicate a time average. That A of XT average dotted into some other quantity. These aren't vector potential and magnetic induction. These are just two generic fields or sources. Dot B of XT. That time average is in general half of the real part of A star of X dot B of X. And it doesn't matter which of these you complex conjugate, but you've got to conjugate one of them. Okay. And all this assumed is that A of XT, for instance, and the same for B, is the real part of A of X e to the minus I omega t. That's the only assumption we really made. Okay, so let's look at Maxwell's equations. They're now very simple with this time dependence assumed. And if we look at the Maxwell equations for the complex field and source. Okay, so we have del dot B is 0, del dot D is rho, del cross E plus, let me go ahead and plug in the time dependence, minus I omega B is 0, and del cross H plus I omega D is equal to J. And all of these have, every term has an e to the minus I omega T in it, so we can just drop it out. And we have purely spatial Maxwell's equations. And again, those, the quantities are these E of X, B of X, that multiply the time dependence. And they're complex in general. Okay, so let's set up a calculation of the time averaged rate at which the fields are going to perform work in a finite volume. We'll pick a volume V bounded by a surface S as usual. So what this means mathematically is we will consider 1/2 the integral of J star of X dotted into E of X over that volume. And now if we eliminate the source by going to the fields expression, like we usually do, this will equal 1/2 the volume integral of E of X dotted into the curl of H star minus I omega D star D cubed X. And now for this dot cross product, we'll use the identity A dotted into the curl of B is equal to minus the divergence of A cross B plus B dotted into the curl of A. Which allows us to rewrite this right-hand side as 1/2 the volume integral of minus del dot E cross H star minus I omega E dot D star minus B dot H star still volume integral. This is the type of logic we've done a million times in the class already. We've tried to express some things involving curls and such as a divergence so we can get a surface integral out of it using the divergence theorem. So now we'll do this and I'll define a bunch of quantities. These are specialized definitions for harmonic fields only. And these are going to be complex quantities. There will be 1/2 E cross H star, one quadratic quantity, is going to be our complex pointing vector. And obviously this is another quadratic quantity, and so what we're interested in when we calculate this will be the time average. Another quantity is the complex electric energy density, energy density from the electric fields, which is a 1/4 E dot D star it'll be an energy per unit volume and WM for magnetic 1/4 B dot H star complex magnetic energy density. So that allows us to recast that in a little more compact notation. That complex pointing theorem is essentially what that formula represents. As 1/2 the volume integral of J star dot E. Again, those are the purely spatial parts of these harmonic fields and source d cubed x plus 2i omega, the volume integral of WE minus WM. Over the volume, plus the surface integral of S dot n hat dA, sum of all those terms will equal zero. So that's the pointing theorem for harmonic fields and sources. So it looks a little different than what we derived when we derived pointing theorem. We had nothing complex there in that discussion. But what this is going to allow us to do is to discuss losses, for instance. That'll come up shortly. So just one point about this. First, observe that if you have real WE and WM, real energy densities, electric and magnetic, which they will be real for linear media if epsilon and mu are real, which they sometimes are to an approximation, but in reality, they are usually complex, have some non-zero imaginary part usually. That in this case, the real part of this equation reads the volume integral of 1/2 real part of J star dot E d cubed x is equal to the negative surface integral over the closed surface that is the boundary of V, closed surface S, of the pointing vector S dot n hat dA. So what do these terms mean? This first term, of course, is the time average rate of work performed in the medium, in the volume, done by the electromagnetic fields. And, of course, this term, this pointing vector term, should read as the time averaged flow of power which you, in circuit theory, you can think of as current times voltage through the surface into V, into the volume V. And I, like all physicists, I hope you realize when the which S means pointing vector and which S means surface, and which V means volume and which V means voltage. We just have too few letters. If I were doing this in LaTeX, oh, that's an idea. Then I could use calligraphic V and calligraphic S. Okay, but I want to consider now the more realistic situation where there are losses occurring in the volume. So let's set that up kind of the way, basically the way it's done in the text. An application to a fairly specific situation that's very common. Okay. Let's have a circuit that takes energy into a volume where some work is being done. And imagine it as a two-terminal linear network. Where you're bringing in power from an outside power supply, AC source, the wall circuit, if you like. I've got a transmission line. And it's going to be brought in through some tiny part of a surface where that's going to contain the vacuum cleaner. Or what do you prefer? Hair dryer? You prefer the vacuum cleaner? Okay.
So is it a dryer? The question in the exam?
Yeah, just to throw you off, I'll ask about the hairdryer. So there's going to be a tiny surface, part of the surface, I'll call little si, a little part of the surface S. Okay, so let's draw it. So we've got here our nuclear power supply, VI producing a voltage harmonically. And two wires from that go a long ways, bringing current, a complex current in those wires. E to the minus I omega t, coming in one direction, coming back. And now this will go into our volume V, containing our vacuum cleaner, with this little tiny hole in our volume V where we imagine it goes into the vacuum cleaner motor, which then as our circuit or vacuum cleaner doing the power, and this is our volume V. And of course, this whole thing out here will be our surface S that we're going to talk about, contains that volume V. But we will focus a little, keep track of this portal for the transmission line. That has this little tiny area SI, which if it's a wire, it's a very tiny little part of that surface. So we will neglect the losses in the power transmission and bringing the, let's use superconducting wires, why not? And so then we expect that the average power coming from our nuclear power source is the average power supplied should equal the power delivered through this portal. So let's set up some math about that. I'll keep that equation up there for reference. Okay, so neglecting losses. We say the average power generated which is 1/2 II star VI equals the power transmitted through this portal, SI. So we would write that as just, I'm not sure I should probably not say that's a closed loop integral. Let's just say it's through that little part of that, which is actually an open surface. We would have this expectation. But now we have this equation that I already wrote. I won't rewrite it. And note that this surface integral in this really is a closed surface integral. And so I can write that as the power through the surface, the total surface of V, break that up into a part through the portal plus an integral through the rest. And so this gives us an alternative expression for this as 1/2 integral of J star dot E in the volume plus 2I omega the volume integral WE minus W magnetic D cubed X plus the surface integral S dot N hat DA, but just over the part that does not include the portal, that tiny part, which could be made as small as possible if you have tiny wires. Okay, so all that is equal to 1/2 II star VI. We're talking about time averaged energy in this equation, or power. Guess I'll keep my beautiful diagram. So if we look at the voltage in our line and the current in our line coming through the portal, we can relate those. They should be proportional, which is basically a generalized statement of Ohm's law, that the voltage and current are proportional and with a complex proportionality constant now, because these are complex voltages and currents. They might be in phase, they might be out of phase, so their phase information is in these complex numbers. So Z, it's helpful to break it up into a real and imaginary part. The real part of this proportionality constant Z is called the resistance. The imaginary part is called the reactance. And Z itself is called the complex impedance. And so, for instance, this 1/2 I VI, 1/2 II star VI, this quantity is 1/2 absolute value of II squared times Z. And so we have basically interesting physics described by both the real and imaginary parts of this fundamental equation. So we now have a connection of the resistance. We can identify the resistance as 1 over absolute value of the current squared, times the real part, this volume integral of J star dot E d cubed x, which is not surprising that that kind of looks like what resistance should look like. Power dissipated divided by the current squared. But there's another term that you normally aren't thinking about when you learn as an undergraduate course, when you're first introduced to AC circuits. This term, which looks like twice the surface area integral, except for the portal area of the pointing vector S dot n hat dA. And there is another term for omega, the imaginary part of the volume integral of W magnetic minus WE. Don't confuse my W's with omega, volume integral. So the resistance is all of that. And the reactance, where am I going to put that? Maybe I will erase my beautiful diagram. X is 1 over the magnitude of I squared the negative imaginary part of volume integral J star dot E d cubed x plus 4 omega, the real part of the volume integral of Wm minus We d cubed x. That assumes that the pointing vector is real. This complex pointing vector. And the main reason is we're going to imagine a surface here, which I've now deleted, to be very, very far away from our vacuum cleaner. And so any energy that gets to this surface had to come from radiation. And that would produce a real pointing vector. So let's think about the meaning of that term that's causing resistance. So taking S surface very far away, only radiation will survive, right? The fields will fall off like 1 over R for radiation fields coming from a finite source. And integrated over area, which goes like R squared, that will be a constant as you go farther and farther away, that area, surface area integral. Because the fields fall off like 1 over R squared, and the area is growing like R squared. So that's discussed in Chapter 9, because we haven't really talked a lot about radiation fields, but only a little bit. So this means we can identify this term and interpret it as a radiation contribution to the resistance. And that will be defined by twice over the square of the current. Absolute value, the surface area of S dot NDA, leaving off this tiny portal part. Okay, so essentially our vacuum cleaner, though you don't normally think about it. Here's Mr. Hoover. With the portal coming in, it's sending out photons, which you don't normally think about when you vacuum. But they are there. And at low frequencies, this is usually negligible. But as you make it faster and faster, your vacuum cleaner can be a nice little radio tower. We can do some further simplification and interpretation. Let's look at the J star dot E term. For ohmic resistance, then J is sigma E. If you see the word ohmic resistance, this is the first equation that should pop into your head as you try to write what Maxwell's equations look like. And sigma is the conductivity. So in that case, the resistance term in our equations will look like 1 over I squared volume integral of sigma times the magnitude of our complex electric field, spatial electric field vector squared. This is the ordinary ohmic resistance. And the reactance for omega over I squared, the volume integral of m minus omega e d cubed x. This could have two parts, then we'll define those two parts as XL and XC for inductive reactants and capacitive reactants. Right, which correspond to these two terms. Respectively. And this connects to circuit theory. In that, for instance, the capital W magnetic energy in the volume as the volume integral of the magnetic energy density d cubed x, when would normally equate that to 1/2 times the inductance times the current squared, which goes, when you do a time average, to 1/4 inductance I squared. And in that case, this XL we defined would equal omega times the inductance. And analyzing the total electric energy similarly, is the volume integral of WE d cubed x. As, for instance, Q squared over 2C, we could look at that as time average goes to 1/4 I squared over omega C. And so we can identify XC to be this minus 1 over omega times the capacitance. And this connects all the quantities in circuit theory that some of you may have gone into more than I have. I don't regard myself as an expert on circuit theory. But these are all the quantities that appear when you do that. So this, now we I wanted to talk about the specific thing when you have a medium that has losses in it, which is section 6.8. When you have losses, they could come from typical ohmic losses, right? You've got the conductivity, energy is lost at a certain rate when there's a current flowing in a finite conductivity medium. But losses can occur and be described in other ways that we want to talk about when you have complicated linear media. So this is section 6.8. Now we do Poynting's theorem a third time. We are again in linear dispersive media. But we add one more twist, which has losses. When you see the word dispersive, what do you think of? What does that mean in simpler terms? Any idea? I can't quite hear you. Right, that basically means frequency dependent dielectric constant and magnetic permeability. That's what should spring into your head in this context when you see the word dispersion or dispersive, is frequency dependent media properties. Okay, so now I'll, because before we assumed epsilon and mu were real and frequency independent. Right, and we had D is epsilon E. We had B is mu H. And so now we will add to our discussion include the effects of losses and of dispersion. How do they come into this whole energy balance game? And I'm totally out of time. We'll do that next time. And then I think we're about on to soon. I'm not sure I'll do it next time. Yeah. We're almost to chapter 7. We'll do a little in chapter 7 this semester, but probably not next time. Okay, see you, and come to office hours if you have homework questions.
I have a question.
Sure.